what's her name? Won't have to answer any questions about it because we all know that the big bad media, they've been so naughty and nasty towards this poor little flower of Alaska, this moose-killing, bear-skinning, fishing, born-again, end-time-believing, wannabe secessionist, eBay plane-selling, chef-firing, beauty queen mom who all of a sudden millions of American women are identifying with as one of their own, so they won't have to talk about it. She won't have to talk about it. Well, she already did, but it didn't turn out so well because she already thought that the two huge lending institutions were government agencies. She already thought that before this takeover. And if we all lose our jobs and get thrown out of our homes and we need some health care, God forbid, we'll just have to bend over one more time and grab the proverbial bootstraps because spending any government money to help those in need is just plain old commie socialism. Bail out the stockholders of Bear Stearns. Bail out the stockholders of Freddie May and Freddie Mac and God, I can't even say them right now. But bail them out. Bail them out. But anybody that needs a little health care, needs a little help with their home or their job or whatever, you can go to hell. Because you don't matter, you see. Because you've got nothing to do with their profit. As long as you've got enough money to buy whatever it is they sell, and they can continue to make millions, screw you. Meanwhile, Johnny Boy McCain is telling us everything's just fine. Just fine. It's just a slight bump in the road. Don't worry about it because it's, you know, he's going to take good care of us. Yes, the Ronnie Reagan trickle-down economics are going to kick in any day now. And you'll all have your piece of the American pie. Don't worry about it. And I'm relieved. I don't know about you, but I'm really relieved that I'll be able to get a job picking tomatoes in Immokalee, Florida, not too far away from here, as soon as the Republicans get those pesky illegal Mexicans kicked out of the country. Don't spend any more time worrying about it. I know a lot of you are worrying about your jobs. I know a lot of you are worrying about your homes. A lot of you are worrying how you're going to pay the bills, worrying about the economy. You don't have a big savings account. You're not going to be able to send your kids to college. Don't worry about it. It's going to be all right. That's what they'd have us believe, those Republicans. Just play along. And they'll make sure you get a half-decent meal every day when you finish cleaning their houses and washing their Rolls Royces and polishing their silver. You'll get to eat. And still, millions of Americans will cast their votes for them because they're pro-life. And they're free market people. And that's all that matters as long as they say that. You know, those voters that vote for them, they may not be able to afford their electric bill, and they'll never be able to send their own kids to college or maybe even public schools. That is, if the public schools still exist. But at least they won't have the government interfering in their business or killing babies. Because even if your daughter gets raped and impregnated by the gardener at her job at a Republican mansion, she won't have to worry about making a choice. It'll be done for by the compassionate conservatives a la Sarah Palin. I love these people. I just love them. They make me want to puke. You think I've got some sort of an obsession?
Has found Barry Gold, who is an out singer, songwriter, and composer. And there's a little bit of Barry's personal life in each and every song on his new CD, which is called Knocking on Another Door. It was award-winning. He worked with an award-winning producer, Mr. Wayne Hahn, and released this in 2008. And by the way, Barry is just now coming off of a couple of Pride performances for this year's Pride, both in San Diego and in Vancouver. Barry explains, "I've always written songs for other singers, and this time I wanted to write songs that expressed what I really feel inside." And while Barry does not keep his sexual orientation a secret, Knocking on Another Door is universal in its themes, and Those are themes that appeal to all of us. Love and loss, even dogs, and diabetic blackouts. Through the years, Gold has co-written songs with talents like David Mustaine from Megadeth and Brian Nash. He also has a deal with Steph Fox at MCA Music Publishing in Nashville, and Barry is absolutely no stranger to Nashville as regarding the world of films and television. He's done music for everything from Stuart Little 2 to Desperate Housewives. Gotta love a range like that. Barry graduated first in his class. He has a degree from Concordia University in Montreal in music composition and theory. And he went on to tour France with a vocal ensemble, and he served as the vice president and general manager of TRI Entertainment in Nashville. And there he worked on promotions and projects with Tim McGraw and Toby Keith and Shania Twain, Callan Jackson, Brooks and Dunn, Leanne Rimes, the list goes on and on. So in any case, we are thrilled to have Barry, and we have a lot of his music with us tonight. You're welcome to join in and participate with myself and with Barry. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4-HIT-ON. That translates into 877-443-2366. That's toll-free. If you have unlimited long distance, you could use that. It's area code 304-658-3333. Again, that's 304-658-3333 or 877-443-2366. Both those lines ring in West Virginia. At the studio, hidden away on a mountaintop, the email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com, and I do try to check the email during the breaks. Barry, welcome to Strictly Confidential.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you, Barry. Barry, am I pronouncing your last name correctly? You spell it with two O's. Do you pronounce it Gold?
Well, you know, my family pronounces it Gould as if it was spelled G-O-U-L-D, but I have spent an entire lifetime of spelling it out for people and them saying, is that spelled right? And I've thought sometimes of even changing it, but decided that would be a bit of an offense to my family. So it's pronounced Gould, but it's just spelled unusually.
I see. That's interesting. I had wondered if perhaps you had taken the name Gold because it's memorable, and it almost sounds like a sort of a music thing to do, a talent thing to do, just to adopt. But it's actually your real name. What a treat.
Yeah, it really is my name, and you know, some people do tend to pronounce it Gold, and it's sort of like, okay, well, that sounds like an artist name, so go ahead and pronounce it that way.
Barry, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you great. Thanks.
Good, good. The studio has lots of dials and controls and knobs and bells and whistles. They can fix that up if it changes, so you just let us know.
Will do.
Barry, you are from Canada, so what was it like growing up in Canada?
Cold. when I look back at the way that my life has gone, it really is a pretty interesting journey. My father was a minister at the United Church of Canada, which is a fairly liberal Protestant denomination that doesn't even exist in the U.S., of course. And they had, you know, ordination of gay ministers back in the early 1980s. And so
wow.
It's a very liberal denomination. But my father was a minister, and my mother was an elementary school teacher. And we moved around a lot because my father felt like you should never get too comfortable in any one place. So I lived in a whole variety of places in Canada, in the province of Quebec, in the province of Nova Scotia. I was born in New Brunswick. And we sort of moved around a fair bit. And, always there was a part of me that always wanted to, if not be American, to get to California. From a very early age, I was just fascinated with California. And there was also, my family still lives in Canada. I have dual citizenship. I'm Canadian and American now. But there was when I lived there, and I don't honestly know if that's still true or not, but there sort of is a national inferiority complex in Canada that if no matter how talented you are, if you haven't done well somewhere else, they cannot acknowledge you.
That's almost biblical. What's the story about never respected in your hometown?
Right. And so it's one of those things that I think from a very early age I sort of felt like I want to be somewhere where people will welcome the fact that I have ambitions and that I have goals and that I'm not afraid to go after whatever it is that I want.
Well, Barry, it's interesting to me that...
To answer more directly your question, it was great. Yes. I think I really benefited by having been raised in a foreign country, because even though I, you know, now am sort of the typical all-American boy, the reality is that I grew up in a country where, and I grew up in the province of Quebec mostly, where English is not the majority language, where being Protestant is the minority as opposed to being Catholic. And so I think it colored my view of the world and made me realize that even though I may feel and look and act like the majority in certain places, I am not the majority everywhere. And I think if I had been raised somewhere in the Midwest, I would have just been, you know, like every other kid in the block. And where I was a minority within a minority within minority, and then add in the gay factor on top of it all, and it becomes even more sort of very peculiar and limited. And I think all of that combined really helped kind of make me who I am.
Interesting. Barry, you know, I've talked with so many people who've, growing up, it was difficult for them to let their families know that they were gay because the conservative families, I've talked to Mormons, I've talked to Catholics, I've talked to so many people. But your father apparently was a pastor at a church that ordained gay folks in the early 80s, so it was a little different for you. Nonetheless, was it difficult to come out? What was that like?
You know, I have a really unusual story in that regard, and I realize that I'm so lucky, especially, you know, when I moved to Nashville and met so many people who were in their 30s and have still not come out to their families because it was just not going to be an option, and they knew that they weren't going to be accepted. In my case, I sort of accepted it within myself around the time that I was probably 18. And within a year or two after that, I think my parents and family started to get hints that perhaps I was gay. And honestly, what happened, my older sister was away at university, college, as we say in these states, and one of her roommates had been married to a guy who came out to her. And as she was telling my sister this story, she kept saying, "That sounds like Barry. That sounds like Barry. Oh my God, that sounds like Barry." And so apparently she called my parents and said, told them this whole story and said, "Do you think Barry's gay?" And my father said, "Well, you know what? We'll just have a conversation at some point." And so my parents actually said, "We want to have a talk with you." And, you know, they proceeded to say, you know, "We love you no matter what," and blah, blah, blah. And then it was, you know, they told me the story about my sister, and they said, "Are you gay?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And, you know, it was as simple as that. And they said, "Do you want to see a therapist?" And I said, "No, I'm very comfortable with it." And they said, "Okay." And that was it. Now,
wow.
You know, I mean, obviously the process takes much longer than that. My mother comes from a Pentecostal background. And even though she says that she knew that I was gay when I was a young child, the reality of accepting who I was and what that meant for the rest of my life, which at the time, you know, this was in the early 80s, and the reality is that at that time there were not the same role models that there are now, and the only things that she knew about gay life were having, you know, random casual sex with strangers all the time and never being able to settle down with anybody, and that was all that she knew.
Yeah, that's
so
pretty much was the story back in the day.
Yeah, well, exactly. As time went on, that changed, and she has met everybody that I've ever dated seriously. And, you know, I can tell my parents that, "Oh, yeah, I had a date last week, and it went really well." Or I can be completely open with them, and they are always happy to hear about whatever's happening in my life.
Well, Barry, you've mentioned you had an older sister. Was your family musical? You even went to the university to study music. So it seems to me you must have come from a musical family.
Right. Well, of course, having a minister for a father, there was music on my father's side. His sister, my aunt, was actually a classically trained singer. And my mother played the organ in church. And so I started singing in church from a very young age. My older sister teaches music to this day in elementary schools, and my younger sister is a singer and actress and Feldenkrais practitioner and a whole bunch of other things. So, yeah, there's music on all sides of our family. It was just completely natural to my upbringing. It was part of everything that I did at all times, and I never considered doing it for a career, honestly, until I started writing songs, and that's what turned the switch for me, and it was sort of, okay, this is the thing that is unique to me. This is my gift. This is what gives me both satisfaction and I think is why I was put here. And so that's when I made the shift. I was actually in pre-law and made a complete turn because I had so much music background outside of college. I actually just was able to switch my major to music composition and got a full scholarship to switch to the program and then graduated on top of the class because I had a strong background from everything else.
How interesting. From pre-law to Nashville. What a journey. How did you end up? Go ahead.
Well, the way it all works is so strange and so wonderful, and I am convinced that everything really does happen for a reason, and I've felt this way for such a long time, and that no matter what, even the really bad things that happen to you happen for a reason, and as soon as you can look at that and say, what can I learn from this? How can I move forward with this? That's when you learn the lesson you're supposed to learn.
Wow, that's a great outlook.
And again, that's been part of my philosophy for a long time. And related to that, when I was diagnosed as being a juvenile diabetic, and I was diagnosed as an adult, I was told that's what it was. And I didn't really know anything about it, and yet had to learn things very quickly. And at the time, my publisher said, I don't understand how you can just sort of accept this so casually and just be moving on with everything normally. Like, why aren't you angry? Why aren't you mad? Why aren't you upset? Why aren't you something? And I sort of said, well, what does that serve? This is what it is. I have to learn to deal with it. And that's the whole point. And I'm not going to stop moving forward just because there's a little stumbling block in the way.
Well, that's a great outlook. And one does have to consider that at least it's treatable. So many diseases are not. Nonetheless, Barry, you're constantly traveling, and certainly, finding the right foods at a restaurant and dealing with blood sugar levels, it's got to be terribly difficult for you.
Well, it is, and it continues to be a challenge. To sort of bring it back to the very specific content of this new CD, I wrote a song called Low and Going Down, which is about my blood sugar. Most people who hear the song assume that it's about depression or any number of other things, but it's actually, at the time, I had only had one blackout from a low blood sugar, which is what happens when your blood sugar is so low, and it's not that you pass out, but that basically you have no knowledge of what's going on. You're still potentially physically moving, and you can even have conversations, although I've never been in that situation, but you have no recollection of any of it because your blood sugar is so low. And this was the only time that had happened, but I remembered it so clearly because I woke up face down in a pile of laundry, which is the very first line of the song. It was so unreal to me because I had never had it happen before and didn't even have any thought that it was ever going to happen to me. So that was a challenge, but it ended up being fine. I explained it to my doctor. He said, yes, probably because, and there was a whole series of circumstances that seemed to make sense of why it probably had happened. And so I didn't worry about it. But to be honest, it happened again last week. And this time was different. I had been in my garage studio, and the next thing that I knew, it was 40 minutes later, and I was in my living room, and I had brought my laptop back into the house with me, but I have no recollection of that 40 minutes. And it's scary because obviously, nothing happened, but I had a friend in Nashville who had been diabetic for much longer than I was when I was living there. And he actually had been in his car and had a blackout, drove the car into somebody's front porch, got out of the car, had a conversation with the owner of the house, got back in the car, kept on driving, and he had no recollection of any of that.
Wow. That's really an astounding thing to happen. I know that concerns you deeply because you drive, right?
It really does, yeah. And, it's one of those things where technology, though, has advanced so significantly. I now wear an insulin pump rather than taking shots, which basically means there's a tube attached to my body, which, it's not a terribly attractive thing if I'm ever going to have sex again, but at this point, I know that's going to happen. But in addition to having the pump, there's a brand new technology that you can have a continuous reading of your blood glucose level through what's called a glucose sensor. And so when I had the blackout last week, I didn't have a sensor in because one had just ended. They have a very limited lifespan of about 5 or 6 days. And one had just ended, and the process of getting a new one in sort of is complicated, and it was getting late at night, and I thought, I won't bother, I'll do it tomorrow. So that actually alerts me, it gives me a beep if my blood sugar is going low, so that I know before it gets to the point where I'll have the blackout. So technology is wonderful and has certainly changed dramatically even in the 18, 17 years that I've since I was first diagnosed.
Well, Barry, I have a great nephew. I guess that would make me his great uncle, who's only a child. He's just now going into first grade, or just will begin the first grade soon, who was diagnosed as a juvenile diabetic. And they said he was too young to have an insulin pump. Apparently, you need to be a little bit older for whatever reason to be successful with that. How unusual is it to be diagnosed later in life with juvenile diabetes? It just sounds so like such a left field.
I know. Yeah, it was sort of, I thought, okay, I guess I'm a late bloomer. I don't know the figures, but I know it's relatively rare. When I went into the hospital, and my blood sugar was very high and I had a whole list of symptoms, but I was tall and pretty skinny and I was eating very healthily and I was exercising regularly. And so they didn't tell me this, but they thought the likelihood was that I was a juvenile diabetic, but they didn't know for sure. And they needed to work on the assumption that perhaps I was, despite my general overall good health, that perhaps I was an early onset of type 2 diabetes, which is what most people have. And so they actually put me on the pills that would have helped for type 2 diabetes, and it made no effect whatsoever. And so they very quickly switched me in the diagnosis and said, okay, no, you are clearly a type 1 diabetic, and proceeded to give me the proper course of treatment. And for people who don't understand the difference, obviously you do since you have a great-nephew who has been diagnosed. A juvenile or type 1 diabetic is only about 5% of all diabetics. And what happens in a juvenile diabetic is that your pancreas completely stops producing insulin. And insulin is sort of like the key that unlocks your cells to absorb glucose and feed them. And so without insulin, basically you die because your body would starve itself to death. So a type 1 diabetic has to inject insulin, regardless of what you're eating or doing, to be able to survive. A type 2 diabetic, which is just regular adult diabetes, which is 95% of people, your body loses its sensitivity to the insulin that it produces. And in that case, in most cases, you can control it with just exercise and change of diet, and that alone fixes it for a lot of people. In some cases, taking a pill might help you with the process, and that would improve that part of it. Or, in the worst-case scenario, there are type 2s who also have to inject insulin to help their body with what it's doing. I didn't know, honestly, anything about any of this. It's actually very funny. I was working at the Bluebird Cafe in Nashville, which is a famous songwriter's performance room, and I was working in the office there with the owner, Amy Gerland. Yeah. I had been sick for a few weeks, and I had been home for Christmas and eaten all my mother's good, nice, sweet cookies. And
Canadian food,
exercising.
Yeah.
And I got back home, and I just thought I had the flu, and I started losing weight, and I was drinking a lot of water, and I was going to the bathroom, and I had all these symptoms, and just, again, thought it was the flu. And then one day at work, Amy said, you know, Barry, that sounds to me like diabetes. And so I called the Diabetes Association in Nashville, and they faxed over a list of symptoms. And I read down, and I said, Amy, I've got all of these except irritability. And she said, Barry,
all of them. Priceless.
It was pretty funny at the time. And again, I honestly didn't know anything about it. And I know so much more about it now. And I continue to learn so much more about it because I'm living with it every single day.
I understand. Actually, I was about 10 or 15 years ago, diagnosed to be in a, I guess, what you call type 2, and I take a pill. I even had to take insulin for a little while, but after I got lost some weight and exercised the whole deal, and now I just take a pill. And, I understand, but, I mean, type 2 diabetes is totally minor compared to type 1. My heart goes out to you. What a pain that is.
Well, you know, and from my perspective, the good thing about it is that at least I'm an adult. You know, when I hear about young kids who are diagnosed, and, you know, one of the things that happens is when your blood sugar is up or down, it affects your mood. And they told me very early on, you know, your friends may notice a change in your behavior before you're even aware that your blood sugar is dropping or is going low. And that is definitely true. But if you don't have any friends around and it's just yourself, sometimes, you know, I'll sort of find myself just getting into kind of a state. And I'm at the point now where I realize, okay, yeah, I need to check my blood and let's see where I'm at. Let's find out whether that's in fact the cause of what's going on right now. And I think about, you know, a young kid who doesn't understand anything about kind of what's happening within their own body really at that point of their lives. And so to have to deal with the consequences, but not to be able to understand what is making it all happen, just to me is much more difficult. And my heart goes out to any kid who's diagnosed and has to deal with it. But again, technology has changed so dramatically. And we know so much more now than they knew 20 years ago.
But Barry, you wrote a song about it. This is just blows. I listened to the track called Low and Going Down earlier today, and I would, it really floored me that it was a song about your blood sugar going down. It just blows me.
You know, the reality is that most people who, it's actually, that's the song that plays first if you go to my MySpace profile. I love the song. I just think it's a great vibe, and the band was amazing on it. And very few people realize that that's what it's about. If you know that's what it's about, and you listen to the lyrics, then it makes so much more sense.
It's
really funny because it's part of the whole thing of why I did the CD. I wanted songs that really would show you who I was in every part of my life, and. This is, whether I like it or not, a very large part of who I am and who I've been for the last 15 years. And so when I wrote it, I didn't know how it was going to turn out, obviously, because when you sit down and start writing a song, you don't really necessarily have any particular intention. And it just kind of came out pretty quickly, and I really, really liked it. I had asked a bunch of my family and some very close friends to listen to the work demos of all the songs that I was considering recording. And this song ranked lowest with almost everybody except for me, where I ranked at number one. And I said, okay, you know what? It's my album. I don't care that everybody else likes it the least. It's going. And the band, again, just turned it into this really fun track. And I'm really proud of the fact that if you know that that's what it's about, it makes even more sense, but that people are connecting to it even if they don't know that that's what it's about.
It's a wonderful song. And by the way, Barry, we're posting a link to your website in the chat room. Those of you who are not in our chat room or listening over the Internet, you can find out more about Barry at barrygold.com. That's BarryGold.com. We're also, Barry, posting links to your MySpace page and links to your YouTube video. I'd love to take a moment to play Low and Going Down for the listeners.
That seems to make sense. That would be great.
Okay. Studio, you should have a copy of Low and Going Down there in the collection that Glenn got to us for Barry this evening. So if you'd roll the track called Low and Going Down.
I don't know how I even got to this place. The last thing I know I remember was heading from the bedroom. Was it hours or days? Crawling on the kitchen tile. It looks like I might be a while. Go coaster drives me crazy. It's up 1 minute, then I'm diving the next. You'd think by now it wouldn't faze me, but what if this is just as good as it gets? Give me something sweet and sticky, or you'll hear me tell you this. I'm low and low and down. I'm low. I'm only rolling here on the ground. I'm low. I'm falling fast, recovering slow. The more you give me, the more I need. You might notice before I know it. You might see what I can't see.
That has to be the first song I've ever heard related to this particular affliction. It's just blows me away for you to be able to actually translate that into a song. That tells me that you're a very, very creative person. I'm wondering if the diabetes associations might be interested in knowing about this song.
You know, it's actually funny. I thought about sending a copy off to somebody, but just haven't done it. I'm sure that anybody who is type 1 diabetic for sure would definitely relate to this song completely, and I probably need to follow up with that. If there's anybody out there listening who knows anybody, let me know or send me a message.
Barry, that particular track is taken from your CD called Knocking on Another Door. Tell us about the title of the CD and the song by the same name that's on the CD. How did that title come about?
Well, you know, once I made the decision, let me sort of back up for a second. I've been writing songs for other people for so many years, and even though I have wonderful connections and I keep getting asked to contribute things lately to movies and TV shows, I had this moment where I realized that if I was to get hit by a car tomorrow, that even though I've written probably over 1,000 songs and I'm proud of all of them, there was really very little in my catalog that somebody who had never met me could listen to and could say, that's Barry. And so I decided that I really needed to do that. And without worrying about what would happen to it after it was done, I really just wanted to have songs that I felt so personally connected to that they showed who and what I was. So having made that decision, it was an unusual thing for me because generally, when I started writing songs, I was 17 and, you know, I had a crush on a boy who I didn't even know, but I was madly in love with him and it was all this drama and everything had to get, you know, put into a song. And the reality is that I'm older and there isn't a whole lot of drama in my life and I don't need to put it into songs and it's just sort of a very different thing. So now I generally only am writing if I have a particular goal in mind. So it was a little unusual to sit down and to sort of say, okay, I just need to write songs that talk about who I am. And the biggest thing that I've certainly dealt with, and anybody who's an artist has certainly dealt with this, is the constant rejection and asking yourself whether you should continue, whether you shouldn't continue. I don't question it very often, but you know, when you have a bad day and seems like everything's going wrong, you do kind of sometimes go, okay, maybe I need to do something different. But in this case, it was really just about perseverance. And so I sat down, and as I have done for most of my life, the first verse came pretty clearly, and it was, you know, been on a mission all my life. And I really do feel that way. I felt since I was a young kid that I've had something that I'm supposed to say and something that I'm supposed to do, and it's frustrating that I thought that I was doing it, and it seemed like it wasn't achieving whatever the success was that should have gone with it. So from that point, it really just became a song about my struggling with continuing to move forward, except it's not really a struggle because there were very few times where I felt like I should stop. And so knocking on another door, it was just, you know, it's sort of that phrase of, you know, when God closes the window, he opens the door, whatever the expression is. And it just sort of felt like, okay, you know what? I don't care if you close another window, I'm going to come back and I'm going to knock on another door. And that's a part of being a songwriter, of being a musician, being an artist, being anything that's creative at all. And I think even if it's not creative, there certainly are parts of everybody's life where you are having to always be, it feels like you're having to always knock on another door. And the second verse of the song, says, you know, I heard California call my name, which is absolutely the story of my life. And the funny thing, after I finished the song and had a bunch of things together and sent it to my family, my younger sister, when she heard this one, said, oh my God, it's completely your life. And that's the whole point. And it really is true, you know, I heard California call my name, I wanted the ocean to wash away these blues, and all I got was sand inside my shoes. And I realized that's one of the lessons that I've learned is, you know, it doesn't matter where you live, you are still the same person on the inside. You still have the same struggles. And it's not that, you know, moving to California didn't change my life in the way that maybe I hoped it would. But it certainly, I have no regrets about having moved here, and I love it here. But again, you still have those constant struggles. And so it comes back to perseverance is really what the song is ultimately all about, which is sort of an overriding theme of the CD completely, but it just seemed like it was really the appropriate song to be the title track, given that it was the first song that I wrote for this project with this thought in mind.
Wonderful. Well, that's a great introduction, and the track is called Knockin' on Another Door, which is taken from the CD called Knockin' on Another Door by Barry Gold, and it was released this year. And is it available through CD Baby?
It's available through CD Baby. It's also finally available on iTunes, and Amazon.com is selling it, and I think a couple of other online realtors. There aren't a whole lot of brick-and-mortar stores that are selling it, but it's available online in a lot of places. CD Baby has the best deal, to be honest, because you can buy one copy inexpensively, and if you buy two copies, it's even cheaper. And so it's a very easy thing to do.
Wonderful. Well, Bob, if you'd go ahead and run the Knocking on Another Door track for us, please. Knocking on Another Door. Okay, we may have a problem at the studio with Knocking on Another Door.
Traveler, no compass and no map, wandering lost and wanting to come back. Yes, I have been tested and everything's gone wrong. If this day don't kill me, I guess the weight's gonna make me strong. Close that open window and I'll be back for more. mind, but I feel the same. I wanted the ocean to wash away these blues. All I got was sand inside my shoes. Yes, I have been tested, and everything's gone wrong. If this day don't kill me, I guess the weight's gonna make me strong. Close that open window, and I'll be back for more. Knock, knock, knocking on another door. Born with the angels at our side. First we forget, then we're not satisfied. Running in circles and always falling flat. Judge ourselves, but don't see what we have. Yes, I have been tested, and everything's gone wrong. If this day don't kill me, I guess the weight's gonna make me strong. Close that open window, and I'll be back for more.
I must tell you, I absolutely love that track. It has such a gospel feeling to it, and almost a touch of maybe a Bob Dylan twist in it. It's really very, very good. And the organ, too, you pull together so many things from the church and from your life.
You know, and it's actually funny. I had forgotten sort of how gospel-y that sounds until it started coming on, and then I remembered. And you know, I probably ought to point out that the producer, who is a friend of mine, has a huge reputation and a huge history in the Christian and gospel music industry. He's won Dove Awards, he's won Grammy Awards, and all of it, you know, that's how he makes his living. But he is a friend and did me a favor because he knew what I was doing and liked what I do, and he loves pop music but doesn't get a chance to produce a lot of tracks that sound as pop as they are. So he got together with basically the A-list of session musicians in Nashville, including, you know, Steve Brewster, who was Michael W. Smith and Stephen Curtis Chapman's drummer for, you know, 15 years. If you watch a Michael W. Smith video from the peak era when Michael W. Smith was on the pop charts and you watch a live concert, you'll see Steve Brewster playing the drums. And so, you know, these guys are so talented at everything, but obviously they got this immediately because it's very much with that sort of gospel touch. And yeah, it connects to my history, on so many levels, and I'm, you know, just thrilled with the way it all came out.
Well, I am too. I have to tell you, growing up in a small town, going to a little rural Methodist church, music like that just makes me so happy. I just love stuff. And the lyric of "If the weight don't kill me, it'll make me stronger," that's close anyway. Great lyric. Great lyric.
Thank you. Thanks.
Well done.
Again, you know, I mean, there isn't a song on this CD that I am not proud of or happy about on every level. When we were finished the whole thing, I was just so happy that it turned out the way that it did, and I really, you know, felt like I had accomplished my primary purpose, which is that if I die tomorrow, you can put on the CD, and at the end of it, you're going to say, that's who Barry was.
Now, Barry, I missed a detail here. Who is the producer who worked
Wayne
with
Hahn
on this?
Is his name.
I see. That's Wayne Hahn. I see. I get it. Yeah, great stuff. And very Nashville. It has a great feel. You know, Glenn sent us a nice collection of your music, but there was one particular track that I just had to go out and get because it's about dogs, which are always near and dear to my heart. I have a doggie. She's a golden retriever. She was given to me, actually, by a family who couldn't keep her. She's 8 years old. And we're inseparable. We're bonded at the hip. She rides with me everywhere. She even goes into the offices I sometimes call on during the day that
wow.
work on computers.
You're lucky, and she's lucky.
I come with a dog, damn it. You want me, you're going to take the dog. So tell us about...
I'm sort of a package deal at this point in my life as well.
Tell us about this song, Completely and Deeply and Generously, I think is the full title. What is the deal? You wrote this about your dogs. I love it.
I did. Actually, there are several songs on the CD that are all related to or connected to my life with my dogs. This song is... in a lot of ways was the hardest song for me to write of anything on this CD, which seems strange to say, but it really is true. I've had one of my dogs, Loki, who is a yellow lab mix, since she was a puppy. And when I moved to California, after a couple of years, I bought a house, and I adopted a dog from a local shelter who didn't have a name, and he was a Rottweiler and probably Shepherd mix. And since he didn't have a name, in keeping with good Norse mythology, I called him Odin. And he just was the nicest dog in the world. But after a few years, he started to have failing health, and he was young. And it turned out that he had a heart issue, and there was really nothing they could do for him, but they put him on a variety of medications. And at one point, they basically said, you know, you'll be lucky if you get a couple of months out of this dog at this point. And I mean, that was upsetting to me, but I thought, okay, you know what, I'm just going to make the most of the time that I have, and that's fine. And he ended up surviving for almost a year and a half. And after he finally died, which was just a little over 2 years ago, I remember thinking, you know, he felt so loved and yet gave me so much love that I know that that's why he was able to live as long as he did. That extra year that he got was because of love. And I felt like, okay, as many people as I've loved in my life, I've never had somebody who loved me so completely unconditionally, and I guess my parents would disagree, but that I have felt so loved unconditionally and completely. And a friend had sent me one of those email chain letters, and it used it wasn't exactly completely and deeply and generously, but it was sort of, you know, love completely and give generously and that sort of thing. And I thought that really applies to Odin and both of my dogs, so I wanted it to be sort of a happy song about the love that a dog can give you. But as I was working on it, it just didn't come out that way, and it really ended up being about, it's not that I have regrets when he died, but that, you know, sort of that you're looking back and you think, if you know, I wish I had known that this was, you know, that this was all the time that we were going to have. And maybe I would have done something different. I don't know that I would have, but maybe I would have. And so the song is really about unconditional love, but not realizing it until after the fact, after it's gone.
Oh, Lord, that brings tears to my eyes and brings so many dog memories of the dogs that I've had.
Honestly, I still have a hard time just even listening to the song. Because it means so much to me, and I haven't performed it live. Fortunately, my shows in Vancouver and San Diego were relatively short, and I was able to say, oh, too bad, I can't get this in the set list. But the reality is that I don't know if I could pull it off live, for a while. It's still in a way feels raw, which is strange that it's, you know, more than 2 years later. But that's how it still feels to me.
Yeah, that's what true love is like, isn't it?
So, yeah, it really is.
Well, Bob, let's roll the track then. It's about Odin. It's a song for his dog Odin, who died in 2006 after a long illness, and it's called Completely and Deeply and Generously.
Not knowing what to do when you were here, but now you're gone. I'm dying to live. I'm living to love.
Done, and I have to point out to you and to the listeners the lyric about the smile. Many people would think we're absolutely insane, but I maintained until my last breath that dogs do smile.
Oh, absolutely. I would bite buddy to the ground, and I'm the most nonviolent person in the world, but if they didn't agree with that, I would absolutely protest.
Well, it's beautifully done and very touching. I can see how it's difficult to listen to that. From an emotional point of view, of course. And
Before
we went into that track, you mentioned the Pride events, and you were in the Pride from San Diego and Vancouver this year. Is that right?
Yeah. It's one of those things where I was recording the CD. It wasn't even finished yet, and I thought, I'm doing this as an openly gay artist. I should just, let people on the various Pride committees know what it is that I do, and then if they happen to be interested and they want to have me, then that's great. And honestly, I really wasn't expecting any response since it wasn't finished, and I don't have any identity as a gay artist at all, because I've just been writing songs, and that, I haven't been in front of the public at all. And much to my surprise, San Diego loved it, and then Vancouver was a very interesting thing. I actually got to do two shows in Vancouver, one on the main stage at the Pride Festival, which in Vancouver is just like a big city party. It's, not a gay event where you pay to get in, and it's sort of in this little enclosed area like it is in L.A. or San Diego. I say little enclosed area, they're huge in L.A. and San Diego. But Vancouver is a completely open to the public. It's free. So I was on the main stage there, and then the night before, there's a promoter in Vancouver who is on the entertainment committee, who decided that they really should be doing more to promote openly gay artists, music artists, in the week leading up to Pride. And so he, this year, launched a thing called Pride Concerts, where there were two shows a night in a variety of club venues around Vancouver. And so he said, look, if you're going to come up here, why don't you do an actual club set, and then you can do the main stage as well. So I got to do both of those, which was great fun. My younger sister, the singer and actress, lives there. And it actually came out in Vancouver. I was living in Montreal, and even though I, you know, knew that I was gay, I wanted to get as far away from home as possible to just kind of come to terms with that. And so I moved to Vancouver, which was as close to California as I could get legally. And within the course of, honestly, it was a couple of weeks, just something switched in my head, and everything was fine, and I was completely comfortable with myself and didn't have any concerns about it, and that was that. So it really was wonderful to get to go back and celebrate the pride of being gay in the city where I really kind of came to terms with myself.
Well, Barry, it's interesting that you bring up the point that someone was going to promote openly gay artists, say, a week or so before the Pride. I have to tell you, we've had a number of artists who are openly gay artists who do music that that is not traditional, you know, disco dance sort of music, who've been on the show and who have talked about that at many of the Pride events, that sometimes it's hard to get booked as a paid act because it seems that they only want to put the divas on the stage. Now, please don't misunderstand. I love the divas. I used to DJ. I've had divas in the show. I love them. But have you seen a problem or at that tendency in your life about being reluctant
I mean, and I don't want to talk down about anything, but
me
I certainly noticed.
Yeah.
You know, I live in L.A., and at L.A. Pride this year, there was not a single gay male performer on 2 days of lineups. Not a single one. And it's not that I was, you know, furious that I wasn't one of the ones chosen, but there are so many great gay male artists that are out there, and it's like, okay, why could you not have at least one on the lineup? And I know there are a lot of things that go into the decision-making process, but it seems like there certainly is a part of the community, and I'm sure it's all political. I don't know enough about the inner workings of who decides what and how. Although at San Diego Pride, backstage, one of the entertainment committee members came up to me and he said, "I'm so glad that you're here." He said, "I have to tell you, I had to fight for you to stay on the lineup. People kept saying, well, let's just cancel him and put this person in instead." And he said, "I had to keep fighting and saying, no, we have to keep him. It's really important that he stay on the lineup." So, there are so many things that go into coming up with the lineups. And I think that sometimes, you know, I mean, I love the divas too, but it's sort of like, okay, and you know, I'm going to use this name as an example, and I adore her, but, you know, Kimberly Locke has played at the Los Angeles or the West Hollywood Gay Pride Festival the last 4 years. What has she done lately? Why? Again, she's fabulous, and I love her, so I'm not putting her in particular down. But it's sort of like, why on a lineup is she there when there are other people that are out there that could both be contributing to the community and gaining from the community in terms of visibility, in terms of awareness, in terms of any number of other things? So I think there's an issue with that, but, you know, I think also some of the Pride festivals are about making money, not really about celebrating what's gay.
Excellent, excellent way to put it. And in fact, a couple of the other male artists who've been on have said that it actually, at least the way they put it, that it comes down to asking, well, what are we proud of? We're proud that these people love us, or are we proud of our own achievements in our own community? And another thing that came up that I'll share with you too is the whole concept or idea of being paid, which is not a bad thing if you do that for a living. That many of times when a male act or a non-dance music act, a person is, they'll tell you, no, you need to do it for free and it's going to be great for promotion for you, but everyone else gets paid. Did you run into that too?
Right. Fortunately, I didn't run into that at all. The San Diego doesn't pay any of their acts, although I assume that Kathy Griffin got paid this year. But none of their musical acts get paid. And I was not paid for playing there. In Vancouver, on the festival stage, artists are not paid at all. It's all volunteer. But at the concerts, I was paid with a share of the door. And so it's I don't have particular experience where I was told that we're not going to pay you, but other people are going to be paid. The way they said in both cases, you know, unfortunately, we can't pay you anything, but we don't pay anybody anything. And, you know, if you are willing to contribute your time, and again, it, you know, in both cases, it was a relatively easy thing for me to do. I wasn't playing with a band. I didn't have to have, you know, pay musicians to be playing with me. In San Diego, it was just me solo with my keyboard. And so I drove down with a bunch of friends who acted as my roadies and merchandise people and everything else. And we just had a fun day. My sister lives there. I flew up. I stayed with her. I got to hang out and just, you know, again, had sort of a fun time. And, I mean, I did get paid for at least the Saturday night show, which was, you know, a nice thing and helped cover the cost of the whole trip.
Interesting. Well, tell us about that. You know, Glenn, our friend Glenn Rivera, never surprises me with the talent he finds for this show. We deeply appreciate it. Has sent me a whole bunch of pictures from the San Diego Pride. That looked like a lot of fun. Were you in one of were you in part of the parade, or did you play afterwards?
I was on the main stage just a little bit, well, a few hours before Kathy Griffin. So it was on Sunday. In San Diego, unlike in most cities, the parade is actually on Saturday, but the festival runs both Saturday and Sunday in Balboa Park. And so I was on the main stage, and Kathy Griffin was the headliner that night. And so I was a few hours before her, but it was great. You know, there was a Jumbotron and it was a beautiful day and, you know, people were just enjoying being out and it was a really fun time.
Yeah. Well, I know Vancouver had to be wonderful. I lived in Portland, Oregon for a number of years and visited Vancouver. It's a great place. It's just
beautiful.
It really
is, yeah. Yeah. And again, it was actually, I didn't realize that Vancouver's Pride was open and was just a big festival. I was at breakfast with my sister at a restaurant, and our waitress was, you know, a 30-something, what I would define as trailer trash, and, you know, 7.5 months pregnant with her fourth kid, as she told us. And we were getting ready to leave, and she said, "Can you believe this weather? Isn't it great? They're going to have perfect weather for the parade tomorrow. I can't wait." And so I said to my sister, "Is there some other parade going on?" And she was like, "No, it's all just about the gay pride thing." And it was just sort of like, wow, I didn't realize that the whole city just participates. But they really do. It's just a big party for the whole city.
Wow, what a difference a few miles make. Here in the United States, you have to fight the fundamentalists, the signs. Oh, my stars. Well, you know,
I think it's wonderful that we've gotten to the point, at least in some places, where that's the case. And, you know, where whether you're straight or gay, that you can still come together to celebrate your identity, whatever that identity is. And I think it's great that we're making progress slowly but surely here as well.
Well, I must ask you about Desperate Housewives. What was it that you did with Desperate Housewives? I've died to ask this question.
Yeah, no, actually, well, and that sort of fits in with many of the things that I've done, which is both cool and really frustrating all at the same time. The music supervisors on Desperate Housewives are people that I have worked with a lot on a lot of feature films, and they called me along with some other people and said, "We're doing a companion CD of music that's inspired by the show. And so we want songs that are sort of about each character, but also about the overall theme and just sort of a whole variety of things. And it's going to be mostly original music. And, you know, we're not sure who the artist is going to be yet. It's going to probably be female, blah, blah, blah." So I thought, okay, you know what? This is exactly what I do. I love this show anyways. So it was a very easy thing for me to do. So I sat down and actually wrote, I think it was 6 songs. One for each character and 2 that were sort of the overall, or each main character, and 2 that were just sort of more the overall theme. And they liked the songs a lot, and then I never heard anything. And then in the end, none of the songs made it onto the CD, which was really frustrating to me because I really felt like I had nailed this one. And it was like, okay, if there's ever going to be an opportunity, this is the opportunity that I'm going to be able to finally latch onto. And when the CD came out, there were 15 songs, and only 2 of them were original. And of those 2 songs, one of them was written by the artist, and the other one was not. But so what they had portrayed to me as being an opportunity where every song was going to be original was not, in fact, what happened. And it was very frustrating to me at the time. I mean, again, looking back now, it's not. Asking me to do, and it's not, still not making it in, and I don't understand what it is that I need to be doing differently. And that was part of the whole process that I went through, where I finally said, you know what, I need to write stuff just for me. I need to record it just for me. And then when it's finished, and they call me and they say they need a song, if I have something that fits what they're looking for, and it's finished, I'll turn it in, and otherwise I'm not going to get my hopes up and wait for this opportunity. But now, having said that, we'll talk about another song on the CD that is related to the same story, and that's the song called Let Go, which was a song that I wrote for Stuart Little too. And they needed an end credit song. And if you know the movie, the movie ends with Stuart Little, standing on the ground watching his bird friend fly away. And it's sort of a poignant moment, because he's having to let go of this close friend, and he's feeling sad, but at the same time, he's also happy because she has found her freedom. And so it's sort of a very touching moment, and so I wrote this song called Let Go, which, if you know the entire screenplay and the story of the movie, again, is so perfectly written for that moment, but it also stands alone on its own merit. Well, in the end, they used the Celine Dion song, I'm Alive. And again, there are political reasons as to why that song made it into the movie in the end rather than Let Go, which, when I was looking back through all of my old songs, that was the only song, or one of the only songs of everything that I had written, that I really felt like, okay, this still really captures a part of what I believe in terms of life, and it really speaks to me and about me. And so I decided to include it in my CD, even though it, you know, had been written several years earlier. And what was interesting was my version that was for the movie was very sort of tender and sweet and melodic and pretty. Actually, if you go to my website, I have my original work demo of the song posted. If you go under older music, I think it's called, it's up there that you can hear the difference. And the band in the studio, when we talked about the song and what it was that we were trying to accomplish, they just all of a sudden started to kick ass, and it was great. It was sort of, I mean, I had a hard time singing it, to be honest, in the studio, because it was so different from what I expected, but I love it. And so I was really happy with the way it turned out on my CD, and I realized that I needed to have a video of some kind out there, just because so many people are video-oriented. And so my friend Leonardo Cuevas, who's a wonderful photographer who took all the pictures on my CD, had a brand new camera that did really, really fast shutter speeds. And given the imagery of the song, talks about, you know, how can you keep away from rolling with the tide, and all sort of natural images. We talked about it, and we were like, you know, that would be an ideal thing for just a whole series of fast motion pictures. And there's a beach just north of Malibu that you're allowed to bring your dogs on, which I love to go to and bring my dogs whenever I can. And so Leo and I went up there one day with my roommate and my roommate's dog and one of my dogs, we were just on the beach playing and having a great time, and Leo took thousands and thousands and thousands of pictures, and then we did a few other sequences, and then he put the whole thing together. We did a few video sequences. He put it all together, and it turned out really, really nicely, and it's posted on YouTube, and there's a link to it from my site as well if you need it from there. But I think I'm really happy with the way the song turned out, and I think it sort of covers a philosophy of mine, which is, you know, that you really can't hang on to anything. You have to, you know, the line is, let go of what you love, because what loves you comes back. And I really do believe that you really have to just learn to let go of things.
Wonderful. This is a few years back, so is this Odin that you took to that beach?
No, actually, the video is new. So the dog in the video, who looks like it could be Odin without a tail, is actually a new dog that I got a year and a half ago named Ginger. Very similar mix to what when Odin died, I didn't think I was ever going to replace him. But two Christmases ago, I made the mistake of deciding to take some dog toys to a local shelter, And then after dropping him off, I made the mistake of going to the back to the kennels. And Ginger was sitting there and did the same thing actually that Odin did, which I'm a sucker for, which was that she was sitting by the chain link fence of her kennel and just leaned up to it, just saying, just please touch me. And, you know, was completely gentle and calm. And it was around Christmas, and I had company, and I was taking care of a friend's dog. And I said, okay, I can't do this right now. But I thought, all right, if she's still there in a few days, then I'll consider adopting her. And she was, and she's absolutely adorable and very sweet. And so that was actually the day that the pictures were taken was her and Dot's very first day ever at the beach, which was a very interesting experience.
What a wonderful story. I love that story. And that's Ginger. I think we have a link to this at strictlycommonaturalradio.com, one of the YouTube videos. We have a link to a YouTube that it starts out with the ocean waves. That's the same video we're talking
about. That's what I'm talking about, yeah. So that's the song, Let Go, and for those the video that we did for it. If you watch the video closely, it's apparently dogs know how to fly.
Okay. I have to admit that because of the developments during the day, I listened to some of your music but did not have the time to watch that video except for the very opening scene with the waves, so I intend to watch that later.
You'll see at the end, and it's actually, I don't want to give too much away because it's sort of fun to watch, but Leo did it just sort of as a joke, and just a little clip, he sent it to me, and he said, look, you know, look what can happen, and I won't tell you what it is, and I said, you know what, I love that, and that is so perfect for the theme of this song, let's keep it in, but just at the very end. So, you will have the answer to the question of can dogs fly.
I'm looking forward to it. Folks, if you're not in our chat room, you can find out more about Barry by going to www.barrygold.com, and that's BarryGold.com. Or you can stop by strictlycommonaturalradio.com, and you'll find a link, all of Barry's links there to his MySpace page and to his website and into the video we're talking about. And he's just done a wonderful introduction to the track called Let Go. And, Bob, if you would roll that far as I'd love to hear. And it's called Let Go. track, Barry. That's very good. I enjoyed all of the track that we've heard. And you do such a wide range, everything from almost gospel, almost Bob Dylan, to sort of a rockabilly sort of a thing going on. How would you describe the songs you do?
Well, you know, that's one of the things that I didn't want to have to worry about. I listen to so many different things, and I love so many different artists for so many different reasons. And so I really decided that I just wanted to let each song come out however it came out and not worry about where it fit into the scheme of things. One of the advantages of working with amazing session musicians like I worked with is that they are completely flexible and know all kinds of really cool things, both that I know and sometimes that I don't know. And so as you're talking about the song and they hear my demo of it and the basic sort of feel of the song, then, you know, you kind of throw out ideas. And in this case, again, they took it in a much heavier direction than I certainly ever imagined I would hear myself on. But it worked really well for what the song was. And so I love it and was thrilled with it. I kind of feel, though, like what I do is more like something you would have heard in the 1970s in the, you know, the peak of the singer-songwriter movement when, you know, James Taylor and Carole King. And it's not that I'm as mellow as they are, but the thing that I feel passionate about is the lyrics have to say something. The artists that I love the most in the world all are wonderful lyric writers. I mean, you know, and my favorite artists are, you know, U2 and Bruce Springsteen and Ricky Lee Jones and Lyle Lovett, and there's a whole variety. But the thing that they all have in common is that they write lyrics that actually have intelligence, that actually convey more than just, you know, a really surface sentiment.
Well said. What was it like working in Nashville? I see that you were a general manager of TRI Entertainment. What was that about, and who did you meet there? Did you meet some of these people like Toby Keith? And
absolutely. I worked with all of them. It was a really interesting time. I just kind of stumbled into working with Tim Riley, who was the owner of the company, for a Tim McGraw radio special. They were doing a live radio special for the album that had I Like It, I Love It on it. And I started working with Tim on that particular radio special because they were doing live broadcasts all over North America. And so he needed help to deal with clearing stations and things. And I had no experience in country radio whatsoever. But I'm a pretty fast learner, and I know a fair bit about a lot of things. So I just, you know, sort of picked up very quickly on what it was that he was doing and what he needed to have done, and he liked having me around. So we continued to work on a variety of things. And there was a whole range of services that he sold, if you will, to individual record labels. And Curb was certainly the biggest account that we worked with. And so, but Curb was a very successful label and is. They have, you know, Kim McGraw and Jody Messina and Leanne Rimes when she was first break. I mean, they still have her, but when, you know, when Blue came out, we were involved in helping to, capture, the buzz that was happening with her at that point. So I met all of them. And it's one of those very interesting things. You know, Shania Twain, what we were doing with her was a very limited project. There are a thing called liners where, you know, when an artist says, hi, this is Shania Twain and you're listening to blah, 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 blah. Well, the reality is that they generally don't do that at each individual station. They do it in a studio for every station at one time, and then the station gets sent it in the mail or however. Now it's done digitally, but at the time it was, you know, it was actually a hard tape copy. And so she came in to do the liners, and every artist does them. And some are better than others. The thing that I remember about her is she is more beautiful in person than she is in any picture you've seen of her, if you can imagine that. I mean,
wow.
She just absolutely glowed, but also was so professional. I mean, she got everything pretty much on the first take, including ones that, you know, tripped up everybody else. And, you know, it's like, is it Colorado or Colorado? And she knew all of that and got it perfectly right away. That was an amazing thing. The Tim McGraw experience was also really cool. That was just after his first baby was born. And so Faith was actually in the studio along with Tim, with Gracie. And the thing that was cool was that they were doing, they were playing songs from the CD recorded, but he decided that they were going to do one or two live songs that they did on the road, and he actually sang an Elton John song, which at the time I had never heard him sing an Elton John song, and it was really amazing to me, because to be honest, I wasn't a big Tim McGraw fan, certainly as a vocalist. I didn't think that he was a very talented singer. But his cover of Tiny Dancer was actually what it was amazing. And I just sort of went,
Tim
McGraw, oh my gosh,
did Tiny Dancer? Wow.
I know. And I just sort of thought, wow, he really can sing. And it was just sort of, it was this eye-opening experience that I don't know whether it was a conscious decision on his part, but on his country records, he did whatever he had to do to make himself as country as he could be, even though his natural instincts were more towards the, you know, pop rock, 70s singer-songwriter-y Elton John kind of stuff.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was really interesting. And again, you know, it was also, I mean, to watch him watching Faith holding their baby, he was so completely, totally in love with the two of them. It was just amazing to watch, and a really cool experience.
Well, I should think so, and how nice it is to hear a positive story about people actually being in love in show business.
Right, it's right. Almost, well, exactly.
Yeah.
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 It was a wonderful time. It was, I mean, the strange thing was that at the same time as I was dealing with this company and ended up running it as we continued to grow dramatically, we hired a bunch more people and I just sort of took on an administrative role. At the same time as all that was happening, I also had my songwriting deal. And so looking back now, it's sort of like, how did I get all that stuff done? I had this really interesting but busy and chaotic day job, and yet I was also writing songs and getting demos done and dealing with all of that. It was sort of an interesting, looking back, it was a very interesting time. But, you know, I mean, I guess we get done whatever needs to get done, which I think is what happened.
Well, I get the general impression that in Nashville, as in most music industry professional, but the whole issue of being LGBT is kind of a non-issue, is it not? Or does it even come up? Is this sort of a,
one of the reasons that I left Nashville. I mean, you know, I have wonderful friends there who I adore, all of whom knew that I was gay. There was no question about it. But you could not be openly gay. My boss knew that I was gay. But most of our clients didn't know. It wasn't talked about. I don't think that the people that I dealt with on a day-to-day basis, I don't think that most of them would have cared. But there's certainly, you know, within the music industry, you know, certainly in the Christian music industry, which is obviously centered in Nashville as well, but the country industry as well, you know, it's one of those things where it's the good old boy network and they just don't want to know about it. And it's very frustrating when, you know, people are judging you based on your sexuality. And obviously it happens every day and it has happened for years. And that was actually one of the reasons why I decided to finally leave Nashville. As much as I enjoyed my life there and I loved my friends and loved many things about it, I sort of realized that in a certain extent I had kind of gone back into the closet to be able to survive there comfortably. And although it wasn't ever that I, you know, had to make a conscious decision to lie about who I was, but to not be able to be open about it, just started to weigh on me. And so I decided to come to California where, you know, really nobody cares. And in comparison, it really, once I got out here, I sort of realized like, oh wow, I really was, you know, holding back a part of myself. Again, it's not that in any day-to-day things that I'm doing something that is, you know, openly, overtly gay, but to not have to worry about making a comment about my boyfriend and, you know, and not have to change genders, not have to think about it, not have to change the topic, to, you know, just be able to be completely open is just so important. And, I still have lots of friends who live in Nashville who are still in the industry and are still having to sort of hide who they are. And I hate that for them. But on the other hand, you know, they love what they do and they're really good at what they do. And so the trade-off, I guess, for them is worth it. In the end, for me, it wasn't worth it. And I really decided that I really needed to not have to worry about that.
Well, Barry, I think all of us recognize that Nashville is the at least the center hub for country and Western music. But and you mentioned that it's also the hub for Christian or Christian pop or the new generation Christian. I guess I had never put that together. Do they use the same facilities and the same studios? In other words, do the groups commingle or is it sort of a big line drawn between the two?
You know, it's really funny. When I lived there, there was very little commingling. It was, you know, two very different things, two very different worlds, and you know, there was virtually no connection between them whatsoever, both for songwriters, for musicians, for studios, for touring, everything. It was all completely separate. That has changed since I moved away. And so, for example, the musicians who played on my CD, who are, again, you know, A-list Christian musicians, but they also played on Rascal Flatt CDs. And so that's something that has changed, and I think it's, and you know, studios, obviously, if it's a great-sounding studio, it's a great-sounding studio, regardless of what kind of music you're doing. Nashville has so many creative people and musicians and songwriters, singers, it's all there, and so it's very easy to get almost anything done there. And you know, the fun thing about it is, even when I lived there and had a writing deal, although I was signed with MCA Nashville, the fact of the matter is that I was never really a country songwriter. It's just I happened to write songs with lyrics that make sense, which, you know, is half of what makes a country songwriter.
Well said. Yeah, go for it.
But when I would hire the musicians to do the demos way back then even, they would love to come to my sessions because it would always be different than what they would do at most of their sessions. Because, you know, it's sort of the standard country song has the same chord progression and the same basic, you know, five different vibes, and it's one of those five, and it's almost by the numbers in a lot of ways musically. And that's not how I write, and so there's actually an expression among session musicians, and they'll say, you know, wow, there's an out-of-town chord in there. That's true, because it's, you know, when you get anything that's sort of outside of the normal flow of chord progressions, it doesn't happen that often, so it's an out-of-town chord.
You told us earlier about, you mentioned actually the track that you did for a New York musical called My American Dream, and you took it, and was it used in the musical, or did you take it and rewrite it for your album, Knocking on the Door?
I wrote the musical and then didn't do anything with it. And when I only had a cassette copy of my demo of the show and hadn't listened to it in probably more than 10 years, and as I was going through the process of just uploading it to my computer so that I would have a digital copy just in case anything ever happened to the cassette version, I realized that there were a lot of things about quite a few of the songs that I really, really like. And so with My American Dream, the concept was there, and that's something, you know, I mean, I have always been a sucker for sort of an all-American guy, and you know, that just is what it is, and that's, you know.
yeah, somebody who likes baseball and
right,
hot
exactly. And wears his bat, wears a baseball hat backwards and drives a Jeep, and, you know, and I mean, it's, you know, the sort of whole stereotype. So in the musical, the song wasn't quite that. It wasn't about that particular thing. It was a slightly different concept, but I liked the basic musical flow of the song, and I liked a lot of lyrics. So I actually just sort of took to rewriting it. The introduction is the exact same as it was in the musical, and basically the chorus, as it is in my CD, didn't exist in the musical version. Because, of course, you know, when you're writing a musical for the stage, the most important thing is that the story gets moved along at all times. And, you know, you don't worry quite so much about having a chorus that's fun or singable. And so as I was working on the chorus for this song, I don't know why it was, but I just immediately in my head heard, ooh, ah, mmm. And you know, sort of a whole gaggle of people all, you know, ooing over the same boy that I'm ooing over. And so that's what the song ended up being. And again, it was so much fun to do, and it is fun to sing live. And, my publicist, suggested that should be my first video, but we just didn't get it together in time just because it's such a perfectly suited to a video kind of song. Although what I actually think the concept may end up being is, you know, everybody's idea of what their American dream is everybody's idea is different. And, you know, the things, I mean, yes, there's an all-American look and style, but the reality is that a lot of different things go into making up the American dream. And so I think the video may end up, when we get around to doing it, may end up being about a whole variety of different people all showing what their dreams are, even if they're completely different from each other.
Well, this is fascinating that you actually wrote a musical. Was from beginning to end, was the plot boy meets boy, or was
I was living in New York. I was Canadian. I won a green card in the lottery, and so I moved to New York because I had a partner at the time who lived in Toronto, and I didn't want to break up with him, so I wanted to be relatively close. So I moved to New York, and we only lasted for 6 months, by the way. But since I was living there and I had some friends who were involved in the Broadway industry, if you will, and so I was talking with them and thought, okay, if I'm going to write a musical, I don't want to have to deal with coming up with an original story, because half the time that sort of is where things go wrong. And so I actually did a musical version of A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Ah.
But set in contemporary New York. And so, I mean, it was the plot of Midsummer Night's Dream, but it was updated, and I actually still think it's a really cool idea, and I think there still is some potential to it, but again, you know, there's so much involved in putting together a Broadway show and so many other things, and, you know, I have to make some decisions about where my priorities are. And so in this particular case, I'm, you know, thrilled that I got this song and one other one that I updated as well, that I really enjoyed the experience and really liked the songs, and was happy to include them in the final CD.
Well, that's an amazing story, Mary. And the last thing I expected was it came from a musical that you wrote. And so let's run this for the listeners. It's Barry Gold, and it comes from his new CD called Knockin' on Another Door, which is available via Amazon or CD Baby, and I think even iTunes as of late. You can find out more about Barry at www.barrygold.com. That's BarryGold.com, as we were posting it in the chat room. And this track is called My American Dream. Roll it, Bob.
Passion you inspire.
We're down to earth but mystic, real but idealistic. Hope someone good as a hometown parade. I'm a pile of wood and you're igniting the flame. Open your door and I'm begging for more. So
love that song, and I really don't know how to explain this, but I'll just have to come right out here and try to get it across. I really like songs that talk about American this or American that are not all nuclear war and the army marching. Yeah, and there are a few that come to mind that I've heard over the years that they're rolling in the back of my head. I can't call the names, but it's really it. Well, I just like them. It's nice to hear something that's not militant that comes,
right. Well,
that mentions,
you know,
the United States.
That's funny. I sang that at my club show in Vancouver and sort of felt a little sensitive and guilty to the fact that I was in Canada and I was born and raised in Canada. So I actually, the very last line, instead of singing my All-American, I sang my North American dream.
Well
to,
done.
Know, to be sensitive to that fact.
Yeah, people don't really always remember down here that Canada's part of North America.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, a lot of the songs that I assume you're referring to, you know, are sort of these flag-waving, you know, country anthems that, you know.
Those are the ones. Those are the ones.
Yeah, you know, the Toby Keith kind of stuff that just gets under my skin because it's like, you know what, there's an entire world out there that doesn't care. And, you know, I mean, I am so happy to be an American citizen, and I'm so happy that I live here, but the reality is that there are a lot of people around the world who don't care. And,
absolutely,
you know, and so
yeah.
It is, to me, the song is about all the good things of being all American, and it's not at the exclusion of anything else. It's just, you know, these are the things of that I really like in somebody.
I think it's beautiful.
When I go back to Nashville, all of my friends know that I have to eat at Cracker Barrel several times if I can, which some people still have an issue with, but I never had that same issue. And so that, you know, the very end, it's, you know, partly country cooking, and that's straight out of my love for Cracker Barrel.
Well, I think that's well done. It's America needs more non-militant songs, you know.
Yeah.
Getting kind of old, got to tell you.
No kidding.
That whole shtick is getting a little old. I want to ask you about a track called Everyone Breaks Down Alone. Now, I did listen to that today, and it's a song about a flat tire, and and God knows, it's It's a touching song in so many ways. The flat tire is probably allegory. Tell us about Everyone Breaks Down Alone.
Yeah, well, you know, it's an interesting thing. That's the only song in the entire CD that I didn't write by myself. And I've always generally written by myself, although I've co-written a lot, and they're just two very different processes. And I enjoy both, but writing alone is something that I tend to prefer to do just because it lets me sort of live with something and you dwell on it and you mull it over and you kind of make changes to things, and that just sort of is the process that I like to have. But in this case, a Vancouver singer-songwriter who I had never met was coming to L.A. to live for a couple of months and do some co-writing and do some performance and a bunch of other things. And some of my Nashville friends actually put me in touch with him. They said, you really should meet this guy. He's really cool. He's interesting. He's fun to be hanging around with, and he doesn't know a lot of people in L.A., so you should meet him. So we got together. We had dinner. We were just hanging out. We were talking. And we both sort of said, you know what, we should get together and try to write, just, you know, see what happens. So he came over to my house, and at this point he had been here, I would say, for about 6 weeks. And we were talking about how, as big as L.A. is, everybody is alone and feels like they're alone half the time. And you're sitting in your car, and you're surrounded by all these other cars, but you're completely alone. And it's really easy to feel that way. So what is actually the second verse of the song was what we started as our first verse. And we wrote a chorus, and then we sort of called it a night. And looking back at it, I liked the chorus and I liked the verse, but I didn't feel like they really went together very well. But I really liked the way I sounded when I sang just our rough work tape of the verse of the song. And so I thought, okay, let me see if I can work with that. So I wrote a new chorus for it, and I just felt like starting, I didn't want a song to really be about just about loneliness. And so I thought, okay, it just seems, you know, again, I'm a very positive, happy person most of the time, but like everybody, there are times where it just seems like everything's going wrong, and you just feel horribly alone at those moments, it seems like. I've had several car accidents and incidents in the course of my life. What happens in the first verse of the song isn't something that has actually happened to me, but I have had a variety of things happen. And again, you really feel like you're completely alone in the world. And so I thought it kind of tied in nicely that the chorus, which is about how, you know, everybody, when you are at your most vulnerable is when you feel the most alone, is ultimately what the point of the song is. So the flat tire in the car is sort of one level of vulnerability. And then being in L.A., and one of my favorite lines in that song is in that second verse, where it says, out-of-state U-Hauls come packed up with hope, empty and broke.
Stars.
Because people are moving to L.A. every single day, and they all have the same dream, and whatever that dream is, even if it's not the same dream, it seems like it's the same dream. And at the same day that they're coming in, there's somebody else who's packing up, and because, you know, L.A. proved too much for the man. So it just seemed to all sort of tie together quite nicely. And then in the end, the sort of bridge part of the song, I thought, okay, I actually wanted it to be about, you know, the death of a parent or a spouse. And then I thought, okay, I don't want to have to set that much of a scene up. So I made it a little more generic, and, you know, the bridge is just, I miss you, I wish you could, whatever the lyrics are. But you're not here to see me. And so it's sort of, again, it ties up the whole idea that whatever the thing is that is getting to you the most, it seems like when you're at your lowest is when you feel the most alone, which, you know, I mean, is very unfortunate because I don't think that's really ever true, but when you're in the experience, it certainly feels like it is.
It becomes true. You're absolutely right. Well, this track is, again, folks, from Barry Gold's new CD called Knockin' on Another Door, available through Amazon and CD Baby and iTunes. This track is from the CD, and it's called Everyone Breaks Down Alone. Roll it, Bob.
Everyone driving home a bit too fast, hungry, tired, and low on gas. Changing lanes, reach for the phone, suddenly my tire blows. Reception, so I'm left to wait, stranded and hopeless and late. Time, time it is everything. Why is it everything's broken, worn out? Ain't that how life always goes? Everyone breaks down alone. Wandering these LA streets, everybody always seems by the dreams they've lost, wanting what they haven't got.
You know, your songs have such a wonderful melancholy often, and you know,
again, you know, it's what I appreciate that. I really there are times where I sort of try to deny that part of it, but the reality is that we all have those feelings and we all go through it, and so I just decided to embrace it.
Well, you did one heck of a job doing it, I have to tell you. What's the next page for Barry Gold?
Well,
what are you up to?
A really good question. And I had lunch with somebody the other day who was just starting their career in entertainment, and I said, you know, so what's your 5-year plan? And so we were finished talking about them. They said, so what's your 5-year plan? And I sort of went, I have no idea. at this point, I continue to hopefully get the word out there about the CD. MySpace obviously is a wonderful tool to help spread the word, and I have found, many people. I mean, I found Glenn through MySpace, or he found me through MySpace. It was sort of a mutual thing, I think. A number of people, around the world have discovered who I am and what I do and like it, and, you know, slowly but surely we're spreading the word. So That's part of the process. I have no immediate plans to do a whole lot more live performance, but I really do enjoy doing it, and did enjoy the two Pride shows that I did. So I will probably do a few more occasional shows here and there. Just continue moving forward. You know, my hope and my expectation is that some of these songs will get put into movies and TV shows and used as they are, and that will help me to pay for the whatever comes next.
Well, I have
I haven't even started writing songs for that yet, and I sort of had this moment the other day where I thought, okay, I know that I need to be focusing on promoting the current one, but I also really need to start working on some new songs so that I have them available and in the can for whenever it's time to go ahead and start that. But that's quite a ways down the road.
Well, very certainly the track Everyone Breaks Down Alone is ripe for any number of movies that are that tone to it. You know, someone leaves another, someone dies. It's really a very touching song, and wouldn't distract from a movie. It, in other words, doesn't call attention to itself, yet it stands alone as beautiful.
Right. Well, thank you. I really appreciate that. And that certainly was my intention and my hope. So far, everybody that has heard it has been very positive, and I've had wonderful feedback. I really have this sort of realization that, you know, this is what I should have done 15 years ago. I don't really regret anything that I've done in my life, but there's a part of me that feels like, you know, why didn't I just do this 15 years ago? Who knows? There are so many reasons why, but the timing seems to be right now. And like that song says, you know, timing is everything.
Barry, just out of curiosity, what part of California do you live?
I live in L.A. I live in North Hollywood. I make money as a songwriter, but I don't make enough to live off of. So I actually have a day job. I work for a very famous studio, doing anti-piracy work, believe it or not, which is a very interesting thing. Just basically at this point is just the way that I pay my bills so that I can do what I really love. And I'm very fortunate because my boss knows what my real passion is, and so she is very flexible with scheduling and timing and everything else. And so it really has been a wonderful time that I've had there that's allowed me to get to where I am now. And again, you know, certainly my hope is that somewhere down the line I will be able to do what I'm doing as a singer-songwriter completely full time again, which I have done in the past, but not recently. It's one of those things that I love the process of writing so much, and getting out the experiences that I've had into music that people then connect to is just such a wonderful feeling. I will do it whether I'm paid to do it or not. I realized that a very long time ago that it's, you know, a fundamental part of who I am and how I express what's happening in my life. By putting it down in songs, it helps me to process it. Which actually kind of ties into what I guess will probably be the last song that we can play tonight. And that's a song called Walking and Running, which is probably the gayest song on the CD, since there are a couple of lines in there that there's no mistaking. There's a line in the song that says, "The waitress was a man, I think." When we were in the studio, I was singing just the scratch vocal, and these musicians who, again, are, you know, mostly playing on Christian records, were all playing what they were doing, and we were in the groove and the vibe, and I sang that line, and they all just sort of, their heads popped off from looking down at their charts. It was sort of like, what? Did you just say what I think you just said? And it was a lot of fun. But again, it's interesting because that song, is a lot of fun, and it's very light and fluffy, but it actually came from a breakup that I had with a guy that I had dated, and it was the first person I had dated in quite a while where I really felt passionate about, and he dumped me, and it just, you know, sent me into a sort of a tailspin. And the wonderful thing about being a songwriter is that I can take that experience and turn it into this really fun, light, fluffy sort of song, but that also, you know, reflects the reality that, hey, look, we all get dumped sometime, and it's just sort of a sad fact of life that, you know, it doesn't work out always the way you want it to.
Wonderful. Well, Barry, we are approaching the top of the hour, and we have another show coming up. So what we'll want to do is go ahead and run the track called Walking and Running, and we may have to fade it early. But if we have to fade it early, we will certainly play it in full tomorrow night, or tomorrow night will probably be a good night for it. And in closing, let me say that you're a wonderful guest. I have thoroughly enjoyed having you on the show, and thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Peter. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I appreciate your support.
Thank you, and good evening to you. Folks, that's Barry Gold, G-O-O-L-D, and we're going to go into the ending of the show with an additional track from his new CD, and it's called Walking and Running. That's his track called Walking and Running, Barry Gold, G-O-O-L-D. And we are rushing toward the end of the hour. There will be a horn section coming up. I'm so glad to have had you with us this evening. Good to be back. Here's Cynthia Manley reminding you, too.
You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief.